This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for the first show of 2022 and hope you had a good new year, great holiday, and glad you're spending time with us as always. And it's an honor to share the microphone with the most enlightened audience in radio on January 3rd, 2022. And as we look back over the last year, it was a very good year for people who invested in the stock market. And usually we have the man who loves stocks like few others, Andy Anderson, with us, but he is unable to be with us today. But Fred Dent of Dent Wealth Advisors is here, and he's been with us, I think, as often as Andy has, and as we know, has a track record that is quite enviable when it comes to investing. And some people will say you can just throw a dart and find a stock and do as well as going to a pro. But Fred, how was it for the year of 2021 for those who make this their life endeavor?
Well, if you were long the market, it was a very good year. S&P 500 was up over 28% with dividends. The Dow was up 20% with dividends. But a little paradox here, gold, which is supposed to be an inflation hedge, was down 3.5%. And that's a little weird, especially when with inflation running over 6% this past year.
877-217-5757. I saw the best two stocks in the Dow last year were Microsoft and Home Depot. Those stocks did very well, obviously, and the S&P and the NASDAQ both went up substantially under Joe Biden, in fact, outperforming President Trump, who did a good job, although not the greatest job among U.S. presidents in the stock market. But the first year under Biden was very good.
Well, so far so good, is especially if you own the top five technology stocks in the S&P 500, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google. You were up 37% last year, which was beating the S&P handily.
37%.
Just in those five stocks.
And what was the S&P final tally?
Up 28% with dividends.
28% for the S&P. So that means if you invested $1,000, you'd have $1,280 for your showing. If you best $100,000, you're now up to $128,000. And for those who are in the high range, and that's where your clients are, if you invested $1 million or $2 million, your 28% is real money.
Yeah, it is. It's been a very good run. The question is, what's going to happen in 2022, and how do investors prepare for the possibilities? I mean, nobody knows and nobody can predict. One of the things that I did this morning early was to look at all of the predictions for the market over the next year. And you can survey 30 of the top wealth advisory firms, big banks, et cetera. And one of the things that you'll find is that there are an equal number of positive outlooks and an equal number of negative outlooks. And so it's really anybody's guess.
Well, this Omicron variant has scared some people, and the stock market the last few weeks has been kind of reeling up and down. Your thoughts about where this is going? Do we have to get COVID under control to have growth in the market?
No, I think, well, let's talk about the Omicron, of course, disclaiming any epidemiological expertise on my part, but it does seem like we're very close to the tail end of this. If you look at the Spanish flu back in 2018, that ran about 2 years, and then it just kind of petered out, and that was had a much higher death rate than COVID has, but it petered out and it became just kind of like the standard flu that we deal with every year.
Well, and if there is this thing called herd immunity, a lot of people are getting Omicron, and fortunately most people are surviving, and maybe we're getting to that point, but at some point the economy has to have the workforce at full capacity to thrive as well as we want it to. But that said, employment is now at a very good level. I think it's actually at a better level, if you believe these numbers, than it was pre-COVID. That's a story not often told. We hear about inflation, but we don't hear about employment doing well. We don't necessarily hear about the markets that did very well last year.
Are you talking about the labor markets?
I'm talking about the stock market, the NASDAQ, the Standard & Poor's, the Dow, all did exceptionally well in 2021.
They did well, except, you know, there were a couple of things that did not do well. As I mentioned a moment ago, gold, But some of the stocks that became very hot during the first year of COVID, like Zoom Communications, those companies that really benefited from the whole lockdown period, they're down. Zoom is down 70% from its all-time high. So some of those stocks were hit. And so it's not all roses everywhere. And one of the things that people are still dealing with, whether you're an investor or not, is that when you go to purchase things that you need, those prices are higher. Gas is up 58% last year. Used cars up 31%. Try finding a used car right now. It's hard. Bacon up 18%.
Bacon.
That hurts.
Well, it's not good for you anyway.
Maybe we'll see an increase in longevity because of the decrease in bacon consumption.
Maybe so. We'd probably be a better world without bacon, but some people like it a lot, as we know. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. For Fred Dent of Dent Wealth Advisors, Fred is an underwriter for this program, and is normally the case, we would have Andy Anderson here, but Fred's okay going solo. And a listener, and by the way, First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for Talk Louisiana. And a listener asked about the best stocks of 2021, and there were a number who did well, and or which did well, including Home Depot and Microsoft, the best in the Dow component. But as we know, quite often stocks outside the Dow outperform those in it. And Andy's one of those who tries to find those stocks. What are some of the hidden jewels of 2021?
Well, we need to talk about this. Bitcoin, the cybercurrency, was up 60% last year. Now, who knows where that goes is anybody's guess. Some say it's overvalued. Some say it's undervalued. But I do believe that the
60%.
60%. Okay. So one of the things that I think you're going to see in the coming year, maybe not next year, in the next 2 years, is a reorganization, if you will, of the whole cybercurrency blockchain phenomena. So maybe we should talk about that a little bit, because it's something that's going to affect a lot of people's life, or everybody's life, actually.
Well, where do you see it going? It was up 60% last year, Bitcoin was. There are those who believe that this is just the start of something big, kind of like Tesla a few years ago. And then there are others who are saying that this is beyond the realm of comprehension as to why. But we've got the arena in Los Angeles now. The old Staples Center is now a cryptocurrency or crypto arena. So what's going on in that world?
Well, there's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of mania around cybercurrencies. So I don't know where that's going, when it's going to end. It seems to me that there will be a shakeup like we saw with the internet stocks in the year 2000, when right before that period in 2000, every stock would do well. You could throw a dart at the wall or the Wall Street Journal and pick any stock and it would go up. And then March of 2000 happened and everything turned sour, and many of those people who had made bets on those things had really suffered when the game of musical chairs stopped. One thing that will persist, regardless of the outcome of the currencies, is the blockchain. The blockchain is the foundation upon which all of the cybercurrencies are based, and that is also known as the distributed ledger. You're also hearing a lot of talk about Web 3.0, that the future and the current and the future web will be built on, and those things are going to continue to grow. It doesn't present so much as an investment opportunity in the actual coins per se, but in terms of the technology unfolding and affecting our lives, it will have a major effect on our life.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. And invariably, we get into these discussions. I know discussions Andy doesn't like about how the market fares under different administrations, but here's Newsweek. The stock market improved significantly during Biden's first year in office, and the president has outpaced former President Trump in some key economic measures. The U.S. economy has grown faster during Biden's first year in office than in any president's first year since, surprisingly, former President Jimmy Carter. Stock markets have performed well. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ hit new records, and though the gains in the NASDAQ and Dow indexes are behind where they were during Trump's first year, the S&P 500 is now considered the market's broadest benchmark and is of major importance to investors, according to Newsweek. Do you share that assessment, that the S&P 500 is the most reliable viewpoint as far as observing how the market is doing?
No, only because it's limited to the top 500 stocks. It is the benchmark. Well, but way back earlier in my career, it was the Dow 30. Everybody followed the Dow. Gradually over time, certainly with most investment professionals, the S&P 500 has taken the place. That goes from 30 stocks to a broader index of the 500 largest companies in the United States. But then you have the total stock market indexes that encompasses, for example, the Wilshire 5000, 5,000 different companies, both large, medium, and small throughout the broad spectrum of the country.
That 28% was from which?
The S&P 500.
S&P. Okay. So the S&P 28%, the NASDAQ 22% up, and the Dow was up 10%.
No, the Dow was up 20% last year with dividends.
With dividends.
Yes.
Which you count.
Dividends matter.
I agree, but our friend Andy doesn't think so. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, another segment with Fred Dent of Dent Wealth Advisors, 877-217-5757. And Fred is correct. The Dow, which now stands as we speak at 36,422, started the year just under 30,000. So it did grow more than 20% in the year of 2021. And with dividends, you can add on to that. Now, Tesla, before we go to the phone lines, a listener asked about Tesla, which was a stock that it is now in the Dow component, isn't it? I believe it is.
I'm not certain.
But anyway, it's up another 10% this morning, up to 1153.88. And I can remember, I remember when it was well under $100 a share a couple of years ago. This is an amazing phenomenon. Can it continue?
Have you ever driven a Tesla or been in a Tesla?
No, but our friend Andy owned one. I like the look.
It's a pretty amazing car. They're very swift and quiet, and they seem to be catching on. And it's not only Tesla. You have other manufacturers as well who are coming onto the scene, including some of, the legacy manufacturers.
Fred Dent is at our service, 877-217-5757 of Dent Wealth Advisors. He has clients in 20 states and on other continents, and he has been at this since, October 19th, 1987?
Yeah.
His first day at the job was when the historic stock market crash of 1987 occurred, Black Monday.
22% drop. I had $12 to my name, one suit and one tie, and I was right there on Wall Street, and the rest is history.
But you hung in there.
Of course.
Charlotte in New Iberia. Charlotte, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Good morning. The appearance on your show of the guest is a nice compliment to NPR's Here and Now's daily and On Point's monthly financial program. And I think it's a sharp contrast to the rolling in the mud, misleading topics that led to the attack on January 6th of last year. Does Fred Dent pay attention to what the GAO states has been the financial basis for paying people during Trump's administration and the Build Back Better of Biden's programs? Thank you.
All right. Well, the Biden plan, markets generally like when government programs involve spending and jobs, even though politically many of these people are Republicans, they like investment. In the second Biden plan, I noticed when it took a turn for the worse, when Joe Manchin said he wasn't in, the next day the market went down. How do markets respond to this sort of thing?
It's anybody's guess from a day-to-day basis, but the markets have generally enjoyed over the last couple of years beautiful tailwinds because of the $5.2 trillion in stimulus that the government has created as a result of the pandemic. So that's really just been a lot of free money out there, and it's kind of fueled not only the stock market rise, but it's also helped out the balance sheets of the average American as well.
877-217-5757 for Fred Dent. Let's go to David in Atlanta. David, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. When people ask me for financial advice, I tell them, first of all, pay all your debt. Secondly, fire your financial advisor. Go to a library or bookstore. Buy some books on how to invest and read as much as you can every day, the New York Times business section and other good financial periodicals, but also I think just buying the index like Jack Vogel would recommend. Just that's really all you have to do is buy the S&P 500.
All right, well, the things you're talking about, David, require time and energy, and some people don't have that time, and they would prefer to let a professional guide them through this morass. Why would that be unwise?
It takes no time whatsoever just to invest in an index fund like the S&P
500. Well, it doesn't take time to invest, but it does take time to do research, which I know you do.
You can even skip the research and just do the S&P 500 or there's some other very good indexes out there.
All right. Well, that gets back to the old dartboard concept, Fred. Some believe that they can do this on their own, and some do it okay on their own, but, of course, others would be better served by having somebody who does it for a living. Maybe it's not a good analogy, but it's a good story. When Buddy Romer hired John Kennedy then to manage his 1995 gubernatorial campaign, which ended with Romer finishing fourth, Kennedy's brother, George, who's a political consultant, said, you don't hire a product liability lawyer to build a house. So when you invest in stocks, it would seem that probably the prudent thing would be to at least consult somebody who knows a little bit about stocks. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I don't disagree with David that the average investor should go out there and do their research, and if they want, do it themselves. I have no quarrel with that at all. The problem is that we are human beings, and this is also a behavioral issue, because over the last 20 years, there's a company called Dalbar who looked at investor behavior, and if the S&P 500 has averaged over the last 20 years 10% per year return, for example, the average investor return is about half that. Why is that? Well, couldn't they have just all bought the S&P 500 and just be done with it? And the problem is that when markets go down, people react rather than respond.
And that includes some people in your group. Some people pull it all out and they don't do it at the right time, or they they get back in, but it's already after some of the losses have been made up. Is that why the investor return is not the same as the S&P return?
Exactly. Okay. People, they do the opposite of the old buy low, sell high. They buy high and sell low. It's human nature.
Human nature. And there are two emotions, as I was once told, that drive the market, fear and greed. And fear, quite often, is as potent or more so than greed. Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, good morning. You're on with Fred Dent. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
I'd like to see if Mr. Dent could speak on multi-employer retirement funds and Geely Automotive. Have a good day.
Jim, could you repeat that? I didn't quite understand.
Mike, are you still there? He mentioned an automotive group, but I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about. But as far as employment retirement funds, do you follow that at all?
Well, I do know that there is a bill working its way through the House to expand some of the retirement availability mm-hmm. for U.S. workers, including raising the required minimum distribution age a couple of years, expanding the amount that one can contribute mm-hmm. into various retirement plans. So that's something all we're right. watching, but I don't know about the multi-employer plan.
And here's a question from Chris at LSU asking about the agriculture sector. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange did very well in 2021.
Yeah, man. The agriculture sector did well. All commodities did well. Oil was up 55%, commodities 30 to 40%. So this was a banner year.
Yeah, these oil stocks went up very, very nicely under Biden, while at the same time some political pundits were saying that Biden was killing the oil industry. How do you square that?
God, if I know. I mean, that's just that's a coin toss from day to day. I did notice today that OPEC has announced that they're going to start increasing production, meaning increasing supply, which should have an effect on the price of oil. So we'll see what happens in the coming year. Of course, we know that rising oil is good for a rising Louisiana. So let's hope that that continues.
Well, crude oil prices, according to some, will go up even more this year. That is good for Louisiana. It's good for the state budget as well. I'm looking at assessment now saying that it could increase by 70% this year. And that's always an uncertain reality. But if that's the case, the state should benefit. And for those who dabble in the oil and gas industry, like oil stocks, like ExxonMobil right here in our backyard, Fred, they should do well.
Yeah, and also the local economy with employment.
That's right. Well, and that's still a big part of our state. But as we know, that industry will have to evolve or it won't be able to continue indefinitely. And at the same time that's happening, we still have the phenomenon of Tesla. Will there be a, that's the last question from a listener. Will there be a viable competitor to Tesla in the offing in 2022?
I don't know if it's in 2022, but competition always exists, and they already have competitors. We'll see what happens.
Well, Fred, thank you, my friend. We'll have you back soon, and good luck in 2022. And coming next, the incomparable Dale Brown on the Dale Brown Court, which will be unveiled tomorrow night at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center. Dale Brown is with us, the coach at Tigertown for 25 years of the men's basketball team, a program that was as flat as the plains of his native North Dakota when he took over in 1972. But when he left the program, it was one of the more remarkable ones in the nation, four SEC titles, two Final Four journeys.
Good morning, James.
And I know you're not a big guy as far as award ceremonies, but this one is one that I think you are certainly welcoming, and it is long overdue. Your thoughts about the court being the Dale Brown Court?
I have a troika of feelings. Number one, I think it should be very clear. My name would no way be on that court if it wasn't for the guys that are gathering for that event, the players that trusted in me and trusted in LSU and came. Number two, I'm deeply indebted and happy that the Board of Supervisors gave me this honor. And three, and this may shock you a little, well, maybe not, but never in my life did I ever, ever have as a goal to be the National Coach of the Year, be in the College Basketball Hall of Fame, or have a court named after me. This isn't being modest or humble. It's being really truthful. I wanted to do the following. I wanted to turn LSU into a basketball powerhouse, and two, I wanted young men that trusted me and their parents that came to me to try to make their lives better. And so this is Lagniappe, 50 years in Louisiana. We decided to stay here. We could have moved practically any place we wanted to, but we liked the people, and I'm really humbled by it, and I'm glad it's happening for all the effort that the kids put in for LSU basketball.
Well, Coach Brown, this, as it stated, is long overdue, and LSU is a very political place, and there are a few naysayers, but more than enough people who said, let's do it, because you are the greatest coach in LSU basketball history. And I think one thing that is notable is that the program flourished under you like it had not done before, and you've had some good, very good coaches after you, some of whom went to Final Fours and won SEC titles. But none reached your level, showing that LSU is, unlike football, it's a difficult place for basketball to be king of the hill. But in the 70s and 80s, you were exactly that. Tell us that odyssey from bringing it to literally nothing to a program for about a 5 to 8 year period that was as good as any in the country.
I was alerted when I took this job by friends that you're making a major mistake because it's a football school. They've never had consistency in winning. They've had fleeting moments of greatness with the great Bob Pettit and Pete Maravich. But Dale, that's going to be your first and last head coaching job. That's a dead end for you. I didn't care what it was. Mr. Maddox was the catalyst for this. And I think people should know this about Mr. Maddox. He didn't know much about basketball. He was an ex-football coach in high school and at LSU. But he met with a guy by the name of Joe Dean and said, I'm going to hire a new coach, and I want you to give me a list of the five best assistant coaches you know in the country and the five best head coaches you know in the country. Well, fortunately, my name happened to be on the list of the five assistant coaches. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if they offered the job to the five head coaches, and they turned it down and they wound up with me. But Mr. Maddox was the catalyst. He had given me confidence that you just continue to do what you're doing, because I told him it was going to take time. I wanted to do it as honorably as I could, but I basically went to his home and even told him that, Mr. Maddox, I don't want to be the cause of you getting fired, because at that time, they wanted Mr. Maddox, a few people, getting older and wanted him to retire. And I said, it's just going to take me some time. We're sitting having lemonade on his back porch. And I said, I'd be happy to resign if it takes the pressure off you, and I'll find another job or go back to North Dakota. And he set his lemonade down. He said, Dale Brown, he said, as long as I'm the athletic director and you build the program the way you're doing it, hustling like they do, discipline and playing their best, you'll be the basketball coach. Well, I think that gave me a confidence that, hey, he will give me time, and he certainly did, and I wish he was living to be there for this, because that at that time there weren't all these high-fluting committees. They paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to check out coaches. He had an oil man from Louisiana, a professor from Louisiana, and a banker from Louisiana. Only one living is Ned Clark, to be on the selection committee. And the day that I was interviewed here in Baton Rouge, there was only four people in the room: Carl Maddox, Ned Clark, Warren Brown, and a university professor. And they couldn't have been more gracious. The one question that they asked, Mr. Brown asked from Lafayette, didn't shock me, but it took me a little bit by surprise, I'd have to say. He said, why should we hire you? He said, why are you any different than anybody else? He said, we've never had any consistency here, so why should we hire you? And I said, well, I'm not sure you should hire me, sir, because no one knows my philosophy. So let me tell you my philosophy, and then you can make your decision. First of all, if you hire me, I promise you that I will do it as honorably as I can. Two, if you hire me, I'm going to recruit human beings first and basketball players second. So you might have an all-black team. You might have an all-white team. You may have an all-foreign team. You may have a combination of all of them. The interview ended. I was now going to Alexandria to watch the state tournament. I was at Washington State. I'd just been offered the job, head job at Washington State. My wife told me, Dale, call me right away after the interview. I want to know how it goes. Well, there were no cell phones at the time. So I'm about halfway to Alexandria, and I forgot to call my wife. So I see a sign say, little tiny town off on the side of the road. I pull over, go in the drugstore, ask if I can use the phone. I called my wife. I told her what I did. And this was her response. Dale, 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 you will never get that job. A Japanese kamikaze pilot would have a better chance than you. Bunky, Louisiana was the town, by the way. And a matter of days later, I was the head coach at LSU and got great support from those three men and Mr. Maddox. And that's imperative, particularly for a no-name guy that came in here. And I'm sure there were those saying, oh, who's this carpetbagger? Why are we hiring him?
Well, March 22nd, as in 2 months from now, will be 50 years since you took the job. And in your 25 years with epic success, you earned a little over $2 million total, which means the football coach now at LSU will earn more in 90 days. He will receive more in 90 days than you did in 25 years. Does that bother you at all?
I'll answer that in two parts. Number one, when they asked my wife to come down with me for a second interview, and then they took me to meet the Board of Supervisors, and the Board of Supervisors had made a decision to hire me, I'd promised the AD at Washington State I would not accept the job until I talked to him, because he told me, whatever they offer you, I'll top, You must take this job. So when Mr. Maddox said the board's, you know, voted and you're going to be the head coach, I said, I need to use the phone. So I called Ray Nagel and told him the situation, and he pleaded with me not to take the job. So Vonnie and I and Carl Maddox walk back to his office underneath the stadium, and he sits down and he says, oh, he said, you didn't ask your length of your contract or your salary. I said, Mr. Maddox, I really don't care. I said, I want this job. He said, well, would this be okay? He said, I'll give you a 3-year contract. He said, I'll give you $20,000 and $3,000 you can possibly make on a radio show or something. And he said, then I'll give you $25,000. I thought I was getting $25,000 bonus here. He said, to split between two assistants. So I gave Jack Shallow $13,000 and Homer Drew $12,000. Now, in retrospect, when I had opportunities to leave here, which I did, I had a job offered 6 times the salary at Oral Roberts to be head coach and AD. I turned down numerous pro jobs. I never asked, ever, LSU for a raise. And in hindsight now, I remember Joe Dean years ago saying, Dale, Dale, in the gravel voice, he said, they're getting into bidding wars here. They're just wasting money. He said, someday this is all going to come crumbling down on him. I have nothing against somebody making a living, but it's a ridiculous that there are professors at that university, world-renowned, that get a very poor salary. There are kindergarten and first-grade teachers that have to furnish supplies for their kids. We've lost our vision. I think that sports are important, but the money that they spend, and I'm just not talking about LSU, I'm talking about all of them. And then finally, the paramount example of how things have changed is, you know, John Wooden was my dear friend and mentor for 40 years. And he told me that when he retired, this isn't secondhand, at UCLA, his salary after 27 years and 10 national championships was $32,500. So times have changed. For the good, the bad, the indifferent, I think it's been totally blown out of proportion what coaches get paid in general.
Well, Coach, congratulations on this high honor. Tomorrow night, LSU plays Kentucky, and the Dale Brown Court will become part of the fabric of the PMAC forevermore. Well-deserved. Thank you for spending time with us today, Coach.
Thank you, Jim, and thanks to the Board of Supervisors and those that supported me these years.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and in our final segment, we're visiting with former state lawmaker Chris Broadwater. Born in St. Francisville, represented Hammond in the state legislature, neighboring district to one John Bell Edwards. Chris Broadwater was elected in 2011, served through December of 2017, and shortly thereafter, he was named Vice President of Workforce Policy for the Louisiana Community and Technical College System. He is a man of immense talent. He's been on this show, and it's been too long, also a graduate of the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary and the Louisiana State University Law Center. So he is an attorney in addition to being a man about town. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. And it was on this date, unfortunately, 6 years ago, that really one of the first bloggers in the country to opine about politics online and create a huge following. And we used to have him on our show frequently, several shows, 3 different programs I hosted. He was a guest that was always welcomed because his insights were vivid and he was unafraid to speak his mind. C.B. Forgotston died on this date 6 years ago. He took his life, and he was a man who was battling depression. But Chris Broadwater, he was quite a fellow.
Absolutely. Unbelievable fellow. You know, C.B. was an interesting character in that, as you described him, a very intelligent man who was unafraid to share his opinion. And quite frankly, C.B. made a lot of people uncomfortable because he had this unique knack of questioning everything and really making you think through your position on things. And as he was my constituent, made for a lot of interesting conversations when you're representing a district where CB was your constituent. But for those who were willing to expose themselves enough to his questioning, he made us better, I think, by making us really drill down to what the heart of the matter was and why we believed what we believed. And so certainly miss CB, as uncomfortable as he made me many times, uh-huh. I certainly miss his input.
He was chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee many years ago. He knew the Capitol really well. And during his time as a blogger, he criticized both Democrats and Republicans. And there were three governors during that period, Foster and then Blanco and then Jindal. And he had criticism for all three, and really strong criticism for the two Republicans, Mike Foster and Bobby Jindal. He thought they were on the wrong track. And because of that, there were some people who took a distinct dislike to CB, but he handled that rather well, despite the fact that he obviously had other issues that ultimately overwhelmed him. Your thoughts about how there was this disconnect between a guy who could take it and as well as he gave it, but yet on the other hand, he obviously had some issues that we were unaware of, Chris.
You know, I think the important lesson for the rest of us, and I think as important as it's ever been, particularly at this point in time in politics, whether you're talking about local, state, or federal politics, is for us to step back and appreciate that the people with whom we're dealing, regardless of their party, regardless of whether they are elected or whether they're a blogger or whoever else, that they're human beings with things going on in their life. And you know, I don't think that CB, quite honestly, is that different than a lot of other folks who walk with things that are going on in their lives, whether it be depression or whether it be financial struggles or family challenges or any number of things. The truth is we're all vulnerable and flawed human beings trying to do our best as we walk through life. And that's what we learned about CB. Certainly, the issues he was struggling with may have contributed to how he approached his job and his input on things. But again, the same could be said for all of us, whether you are broadcast in a radio show or whether you're an elected official. We don't live in a vacuum. We bring all of our baggage with us to whatever issue we're tackling. And that doesn't separate CB out as different. It means he was just like the rest of us.
Were you aware of the depth of his depression?
No, I was not in terms of how big of a struggle it was for him. Looking back on it now, I certainly can see different periods during our relationship where he struck me as different. In fact, the last conversation that I had with him was markedly different from all of the others. And it was only a week or so before his death. We spent about an hour and a half together talking about the upcoming inauguration of Governor John Bel Edwards and the politics going on in the House chamber. And he was as calm and as loving and as insightful as I'd ever seen. And I've shared that with his wife, EJ, that one of the greatest meetings I had with him. Looking back on it now, easier for me to understand that maybe that was a period in his life where the depression was really affecting him. And I hate I didn't know it and couldn't have done more to intervene in that, because it's certainly a loss for all of us.
And that was a week and a half before he died.
Yes.
Mm. Well, you worked under Governor Jindal, who he criticized mightily. And that had to be somewhat interesting, because you had this respect for CB, and yet at the same time you were a Republican working in an administration, and quite often you have to take it on the chin and back some things you otherwise wouldn't and oppose some things you might not, because that's what the administration wants. Was that hard for you?
Not necessarily. That didn't really change even in the next term, serving with my good friend, Governor Edwards. while I served under a Republican governor, being a Republican, the following term served under a Democratic governor who was from my home area. All of his family lived in my district. And so, look, there are relationships, and everyone's district is different. What I tried to do the entire time I was there was, in spite of whoever was governor, in spite of whatever the politics of the House chamber were, I tried to represent the people who sent me there. And I didn't do well at that sometimes, and other times I think I did better. That creates tension whenever you do that. It's the same thing that I think you see with Senator Manchin right now at the federal level, you know, representing a ruby red district as a Democrat, and it makes him unpopular with his party. That happens to a number of us, whether Republican or Democrat, if we stay true to representing the people that sent us there. It's not an easy job, particularly with the outspokenness and diversity and opinions and the prevalence of social media these days. It's harder and harder for all elected officials in that regard. But it was an enjoyable job. That's just part of the job. The only thing that's changed through the years is I think with redistricting, districts have become more lopsided in each direction, going towards the fringes. And with the prevalence of the ability to communicate through social media, it makes it a little different than in years past. But that's been the nature of the job forever. There will always be conflict in opinions, and every elected official, whether they're Republican or Democrat, has to struggle with what is right for the people who sent me there. And there will always be someone who disagrees with the decision. That's part of it.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to get under the wire with Chris Broadwater, former state lawmaker and now involved in an important endeavor. And Jan Swift, who hosts this show on occasion, says great interview on CB. He was a wonderful friend to me, especially as a young professional trying to find my way. He was one of a kind, always supportive, always challenging to me to think for myself. That from Jan Swift about CB for Godston, who left quite a legacy. And another listener, this is Tracy at the Capitol, noting that you did work in the legislature for 2 years under John Bel Edwards, and asking how big of a blow was it when John Bel Edwards lost his quest to have Walt Leger as Speaker of the House? Was that a blow that was a tough one right at the start of his administration?
For him or for me?
Well, for all three of you.
You know, I think it was a constant learning process. The politics are. I think from his perspective, and it's just my opinion, I think that did start him off on a little bit of a rocky start, not getting that win under his belt right away. You know, I think Walt Leger, one of the most talented legislators we've seen in decades in that chamber, would have been fantastic. But even not in the speaker's role, Walt continued to be a tremendous leader in that chamber. It was a learning process for all of us. Look, bringing in a Democratic governor with a legislature that has almost a supermajority Republican House, and I guess at that time almost a supermajority, or did have a supermajority Senate, you're going to have those sorts of things. It was an opportunity for learning, and I hope that we all learned something from it. I'm not sure all of us did, but it was certainly a learning opportunity.
And we only have a few seconds, but next time we'll hear more about your work with the Louisiana Community and Technical College System. But I know you're quite proud of your tenure there, Chris.
Hey, look, this is a fantastic organization and some great things happening now. The President Paige Cortez and Speaker Clay Schick-Schneider offered a bill this past year that Governor Edwards signed. It's the Murphy J. Foster Promise Program. That for the first time in our state's history, there will be dollars available for adults to get access to training, which is going to be so important right now following the pandemic and people change.
All right, we do have to roll. But Chris Broadwater, let's talk again soon. It's been too long. Congratulations on your role today. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Back tomorrow. Stay safe. Stay tuned.